Welcome to Medical Progress Today's Innovative Ideas series. I'm Paul Howard, the director of the Center for Medical Progress at the Manhattan Institute. Innovative Ideas is a series of podcast interviews conducted with doctors, scientists, health economists, and policy experts to get their thoughts on how we should reform our healthcare system in a way that promotes innovation, competition, and more affordable health insurance options. Joining us today in the Innovative Ideas podcast is Sydney Torrell, former CEO and chairman of Eli Lilly, one of the world's largest pharmaceutical companies with approximately 40,000 employees and nearly $19 billion in global sales. Mr. Torrell stepped down as Eli Lilly chairman on December 31st, 2008. He's joining us today to talk about the future of the pharmaceutical industry, the future of healthcare, and the importance of thinking of healthcare as an investment in human capital. Sydney, although the industry is more international in scope than it ever has been before, it remains critically dependent on the U.S. to maintain its profit margins. Based on some of the more recent data I've seen, I think the industry generates about 50% of its global profits in the U.S. Ultimately, is this disparity that is between the U.S. and other wealthy countries, particularly in Europe, sustainable in your view?
No, I don't think so, but I first want to debunk a misconception that prices are higher in the U.S. because they are held down artificially by price controls outside of the U.S. I think the U.S. prices are set based on competitive forces which prevail in the U.S. market. Prices outside of the U.S. are lower than, at least for innovative products, for patented drugs, are lower than where they should be because of price controls. There was a study made by the Department of Health and the Commerce Department about 3 years ago, which looked at what would be the implications for human health if prices in developed countries, particularly in Western Europe and Japan, were at about the same level as in the U.S. And the response was that the industry would be able to generate, something like $15 billion more in profits per year, which in turn would, sales, which in turn would result in some $5 billion more of investment in R&D, which in turn would result in at least 3-4 new products more per year that basically mankind would benefit from. So how do we get to a more market-based price system outside of the U.S.? That's a long question, quite frankly. We've been working at it for a long time. I think the answer goes through some of the improvements we can make in the way we demonstrate the value of pharmaceuticals to public payers and do the same as what we do with private payers in the U.S. It is also through a demonstration of the value of the industry itself to the developed world. At the time when a lot of the low intellectual content industries have left forever the developed world, it is very important to invest in the knowledge-based industries, and certainly Europe and even more so the U.S. have a very important stake in ensuring that they continue to have the lead in innovation, and therefore market pricing for pharmaceuticals is part of the solution to continue to foster that innovation.
And of course, I think it started perhaps during the early 1990s that there was a shift in the center of gravity of the industry from Europe to the U.S. precisely because of those price control policies that you discussed earlier, and that's obviously been of enormous benefit to U.S. industry and U.S. consumers because they tend to get faster access to new medicines because of the relatively deregulated market for pricing in the U.S. Is that right?
Yes, broadly speaking, it's right. I think it started probably earlier than the 1990s. It accelerated during that period of time, but I think it can be traced back to the adoption of price controls in Europe, which date back really about 40 years. And at that time, investment in R&D in Europe represented about 60% of the worldwide investment in R&D. That 60% has become now 25% after those 40 years of price control. So that just illustrates the danger should we in the U.S. move to a more regulated price controlled environment. What could happen to investment in innovation.
And I think for people who don't follow the industry or look at it historically, that it seems like there's a dearth of new products coming to market right now. And I think some of that is accurate. But I think some of it also seems to be cyclical, that people have to understand that the innovation cycle for the industry is very long in the terms of the time it takes to move from a potential new drug candidate to a marketed product requires an enormous outlay of time, effort, and, of course, money to bring that product to market. How much of that, you know, quote-unquote drug lag that we're seeing right now, or is perceived right now, do you think is a product of just a natural innovation cycle in the industry in terms of trying to assimilate new sciences and new scientific discoveries like the deciphering of the human genome and trying to make sense of that, you know, versus regulatory risk in terms of people at the FDA or other regulatory agencies seeing safety problems and reacting in a very risk-averse way?
Okay, first, a couple of statistics regarding the point that you made earlier, which is the cost and risk of bringing products to market. It costs approximately $1.5 billion today to bring a product to market. This cost includes both the time value of money, which takes into account the 12 to 15 years it takes to bring a product to market, and the cost of what we call the dry runs, all the failures on the way to getting a product to market. We start with roughly 5,000 molecules to get one eventually to the market. Even if we look at the last stages, let's say the last 8 years of research on a given compound, what we call the clinical trials, basically when it's given to humans, only one product out of about seven or so make it to the market. And once they get to the market, about 3 out of 10 pay for the investment in R&D. So this has been going on for a while, but the costs of that have gone up tremendously. First, because there is a very high medical cost inflation that's faster than the overall rate of inflation, so the cost per unit of R&D, if you will, goes up. Secondly, because we have had more search for breakthroughs, since payers are becoming more and more demanding, they will not, as they would have 20 years ago, accepted what are called Me Too products, unless they come in at a much, much lower price. And therefore, innovative companies have been trying to bring to market products which are clear innovations versus what exists in the market, and rather than just very marginal improvements or Me Too products. And that has in turn increased the rate of attrition, the failure rate, and that is one of the key contributors to the overall cost and the fact that there are less products coming out. And then there is another driver of this reduction in productivity, which you mentioned, and that is that as regulators are becoming more and more cautious, as the debate over benefit versus risk of pharmaceuticals has been more and more tilted towards the discussion of risk, both regulators and companies now are becoming much more conservative in which products do they actually pursue and develop. And if there are any indications early in the development cycle of, let's say, some cardiotoxicity or liver toxicity, we might kill very early a product which otherwise, you know, could have made it to the market with perhaps a restriction on which patients should be taking it, but now they are being killed, and therefore that has reduced the number of new products. This is the current trend. I think there are a lot of signs of hope when you look at the pipelines of the industry, including the one of my company, Eli Lilly. It's never been so plentiful in terms of products which are in what is called phase 2 and phase 1 of clinical trials. We don't have a lot in phase 3, the last stage, for the reasons I mentioned. But some of the improvements we've made over the last decade in new technologies has helped spawn a whole slew of new products, which, if they make it to market, and then some will, obviously, at the beginning of the next decade, hopefully we'll see a resurgence of productivity.
Of course, you've been in the industry since you began work with Eli Lilly back in the early 1970s. Do you think it's fair to say that the industry is a victim of its own success in this sense, that we take for granted that the vast majority of pharmaceuticals that we take right now for common illnesses like diabetes or heart disease are, in fact, in point of fact, very safe, and that has, in a sense, made us less able to recognize the benefits because we take them so for granted that tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of patients can take these pills daily with no side effects or very few side effects. And so that when there are rare problems that pop up for many reasons, perhaps the 24-hour news cycle now, but for other reasons, these stand out in a way that they would not have stood out in a different era when we didn't have as many treatments and they weren't as routinely safe as they are now. Do you think that's a fair thing to note?
Yes, it is. I think we are a victim of our success in that sense, but also in the sense that thanks to pharmaceuticals and other improvements, you know, life expectancy has increased. We live longer, and with longer life come some more chronic diseases, the disease of the aged, that are adding to healthcare costs, and sort of the blame is being put on more expenditures in pharmaceuticals, you know, which have helped people live longer. So we are twice, if you will, the victims of our own success.
But it's a problem that we really ought to have. It's the best problem to have, is how to decide how to live longer, how to better live longer.
Indeed. And there are many things to do to address those two issues. And I think the best promise is in a sort of reinvention of how we discover and develop new drugs. In a nutshell, today when we develop a new product, we test it on people who have a certain disease, and then we offer it to physicians and say, you know, try it, use it in the people who have that particular disease. But success rate varies tremendously from individual to individual, and the products for cholesterol, the statins, you know, work on maybe 80% of the patients who take them. Some anti-cancer drugs will work only on 10 or 20% of the patients. On average, it's about 50% success rate on the use of pharmaceuticals. If we could change this 50% to a 70, 80, or 100%, we would avoid an enormous amount of waste. We also have people who suffer from side effects of products. If we could predict who are the people who are most likely to suffer from those side effects, we would not give them that product and reduce, again, a lot of cost and human suffering.
And you also improve, and this here I think you're talking about developing biomarkers for drugs that help match the right product to the right patient with the right illness. That also improves transparency for the patient, the physician, for the regulator who understand what the benefits and then the potential risks of the ailment are. And you think this will help the industry ultimately reconcile these competing demands of payers, regulators, and patients for more transparency or more value transparency for the product?
I do. I'm talking not just about biomarkers, but about all the tools which are helping us move to this concept of tailored therapies, you know, getting eventually to the right drug for the right patient at the right time, at the right dosage, which will address the dual issue of cost versus benefit and benefit versus risk by avoiding to give drugs to people who don't need them or would not benefit from them optimally. We reduce waste and improve, therefore, the productivity of the of the treatment. And by ensuring that those people who are more likely to suffer from toxicity or side effects do not take the drug or take it at a reduced dosage or what have you, or mixed with something else, you reduce the perception of and the reality of risk, and therefore the benefit to risk ratio is also improved. So we have a number of new technologies which are helping us envisage that future, and we've started to move towards it. Besides the biomarkers, which help us define which are the best patients for given drugs, we have other new technologies like pharmacogenomics, metabolomics, proteomics, etc., that are helping us design drugs every day in a more targeted fashion and move towards that future. But the concept itself of tailored therapies is one that doesn't necessarily require for all these new technologies to fully come to fruition. It's more of a philosophy that we can apply today to our existing products with our existing tools. Let me give you one simple example of a product for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which we have at Lilly. It's a non-stimulant drug. It's called Strattera. And we found that for the average patient with ADHD, it didn't really work better than the old stimulant drug. Ritalin and others. However, in analyzing all of our clinical data, we found that if when the drug was used in patients who had ADHD associated with anxiety, then it worked on 2/3 of the patients, while the stimulants are contraindicated in those patients because they make their condition worse. So therefore, tailoring the product specifically for that subset of the population of ADHD patients who have associated anxiety helped, you know, improve the outcome and get to a better result for patients and for payers alike, because the product is used on a more targeted population with better chances of success, while the stimulants are being used for the rest of the population. So that's just one example of applying the philosophy of tailoring using existing drugs and existing tools. But we are more and more developing new tools, for example, in helping us re-engineer some large molecule like proteins. We bought a company at Lilly a few years ago called Advanced Molecular Evolution, which helps us modify proteins in order to change some of their properties and therefore reduce the potential for some side effect or toxicity, or improve activity in certain patients, or improve the potency of the drug. And then we are right now working on a molecule which will address the part of the population with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which does not respond to the current standard of treatment called Rituxan, using that technology. And there are many, many, many examples like that. And at Lilly, every one of the drugs which are under development has a tailoring strategy associated with it. And I think a lot of our competitors have been also moving in that direction at varying speeds.
This is obviously also a framework that Lilly and other companies are working in that's political and being driven by the concerns of policymakers in Washington and, of course, in other capitals around the world. Over the next 5 to 10 years, are you optimistic about the industry's ability to meet the challenges of both innovation and, of course, greater demands from the healthcare industry in terms of dealing with an aging population in a way that fits in with all the priorities of improving health and controlling costs? And as a sidebar to that, if you can, how do you see the rise of China and India and other developing nations that are focusing on biotech affecting the global development of the industry and perhaps adding to its innovation base?
In terms of the promise of science to address the issues you mentioned, I'm very optimistic. The tools that we have at our disposal today and our better understanding of systems biology makes me very optimistic that solutions can be found eventually to most ailments that affect the human race. And we do have, as we know all, a number of diseases for which today we don't have a good solution. But for that potential to be realized, we need to ensure that public policies continue to foster innovation. And one thing which has concerned me in the current debate over healthcare reform in this country is that the word innovation is very seldom, if ever, being used. And yet, the purpose, I think, of any reform should be to continue to foster the kind of innovation which has brought about all the improvements that we've enjoyed over the last century in healthcare. In fact, I'm concerned that some things which are being discussed would go counter to that fostering of innovation. Things such as a public health plan that might eventually dictate prices to pharmaceutical companies. Experience that we have had in Europe and Japan that we talked about earlier shows that if you have price controls or even the threat of price controls, you see a reduction in the investments which are being made in the risky business of innovation. Another area which would be of concern is if anything was done to reduce the strength of intellectual property, which is a sine qua non condition for innovation to flourish. And currently there are some discussions on so-called follow-on biologics or generic biologics, if you will, that in principle, I think, and under certain scientific conditions, are totally appropriate. However, it is important that good intellectual property protection be linked to any change in status for these for biologics. And as generic biologics are brought to the market, that we have a good solid 14 year of protection for the originator product. If this was to erode, I think it would have a very negative impact on innovation. So basically, ensuring market access, ensuring a market-based pricing system, and ensuring good intellectual property protection, those are the three conditions for innovation to continue to flourish. Other things which are part of the ecosystem of innovation in the U.S. Hopefully will continue, and I'm talking about, you know, continued and hopefully increased investment in the NIH, which does some basic research, which opens avenues of research for the applied research that the biopharmaceutical industry does. Secondly, the availability of venture capital in order to invest in the early ideas, early molecules that are then later on developed by large biotech or pharmaceutical companies. All of these areas, or these ecosystems, if you will, the U.S. has a competitive advantage, and I hope that it will continue to do so, especially as I mentioned earlier, as we realize as a society that our mission should be to invest more and more in the knowledge-based activities where we can hopefully maintain an advantage. As you mentioned, India and China are making progress in those areas too, and I think rather than seeing that as a threat, I think it has to be seen in the context of how innovation is in pharmaceuticals is evolving. We are moving from the concept of what we used to call FIPCO, or fully integrated pharmaceutical company, where we would own all of the elements of the value chain, to one of FIPNet, fully integrated pharmaceutical network, where actually we are talking much more about collaboration among various entities, academia, pharmaceutical companies, biotech companies, individual researchers, etc., across the globe. And I think since we need to bring together so many different technologies, and you know, no company can hope to have a hold on all the state of the art technologies, this ability to collaborate across boundaries, across scientific disciplines, and across the globe is becoming more and more important in the development of new ideas and new drugs. And certainly at Lilly, we've moved very much in that direction of FIPNet.
Well, I think, just to turn back to our earlier topic of conversation, which is the problems that we face right now in terms of ensuring a high quality of health as we age is a problem that's really a blessing, and that the industry has contributed to expanding human lifespans and quality of life at older and older ages. And these are their problems only relative to our affluence, in effect.
Yes. If I may add something here, I think by enabling us to enjoy a longer life and also enjoy a more active life for a much longer period of time, we've sort of, you know, brought a new wedge in our lives, the age from let's say 60 to 80, which used to be old age, is no longer so. At least let's say 60 to 75, and we have the ability now to become to continue to be productive. And as baby boomers are retiring, it is going to become more and more important for continued economic growth to have people work longer. And we at least have the ability to do so thanks to advances in medicine. I think the economic circumstances linked to this demographic evolution I just mentioned will also make it necessary, I think, for people to work longer, and that will be to the benefit of society as a whole through continued growth. Growth cannot come only from, you know, improvements in productivity. It has to come also from, you know, an increase in the workforce, and with the retirement of the baby boomers, again, we would need to multiply by 4 or 5 the current levels of immigration over the next 20 years to make up for this. So people staying longer active will be a condition for continued growth of our economy.
In effect, rather than seeing this as a problem, you need to see it as an opportunity for human capital, because now you do have people who can maintain their productivity and obviously their intelligence and their ability to participate in the workforce at much, much older ages, which hopefully will be a kind of solution to some of the budget problems that we're facing here. Exactly. In the developed West.
Exactly, and it comes back to basically not looking at healthcare just as a cost and a burden, but rather as an investment in human capital.
Absolutely. And on that note, I'd like to thank you for your time today and welcome you back to the Innovative Ideas podcast series in the future to discuss more developments in healthcare.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To listen to this podcast and other podcasts in the Innovative Ideas series, go to www.medicalprogresstoday.com and click on the podcast tab.